映画ナイト。
Hello everybody and welcome to another episode of Eiga Night, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the wild and wonderful world of Japanese cinema. I am your co-host Chris Luciantonio, and I will not be joined this week by my co-host Aruba. Scheduling conflict has led us to not be able to record our promised Akira episode, unfortunately. But in lieu of that, we have another entry in the Eiga Night special guest series. Joining me this week is one of my dear friends from my York University Cinema Media Studies program, Anthony Moss. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Chris. Happy to be here.
Happy to be here after so many technical issues. I don't want to bring that up on the episode itself, but it's kind of all that it's on my mind right now.
Totally fair. For context, my internet connection has been kind of unstable. My mic has been giving us issues, but it seems that it's working for now. So hopefully nothing else decides to intervene on our very, very awesome conversation we're about to have today.
Yes, fingers crossed that all goes as planned. I mean, it already has not gone as planned, so I don't know where to go from here. But I think we'll start where we always start, with our special guest. Anthony, what is your history with Japanese cinema?
So I guess my introduction to it was very structured. In my undergraduate degree, also at York, I was introduced to it through the film High and Low when we were kind of being introduced to it. And it's funny because I went into university not with the intention, I hadn't seen films with subtitles before because I was bored by them. I wasn't terribly interested in non-North American films. I wanted to make the next Die Hard. But ironically enough, I Kurosawa would have come on my radar anyway, because I was interested in Star Wars and stuff, so eventually it was going to I was gonna eventually probably watch at least Seven Samurai or something. But I watched High and Low as part of a class, and from there it just totally that and a collection of other world cinema films totally changed my perspective and made me way more interested to study films critically, and really changed my taste in film overall. Those Japanese golden age filmmakers like Mizoguchi, Ozu, Kurosawa, they really got me completely interested in film in a totally new way. Movies like Ugetsu, High and Low just engaged me in a totally different level. So I knew I had to study it.
Sometimes it is good to get the basic education when you're approaching a world cinema. You don't necessarily need to start on that, and that's not necessarily where you need to stay for much of your tour through a nation's cinematic output, but especially with a country like Japan, and that has had several golden age before they even considered putting films into color. It seems quite arrogant to think that you could start anywhere outside of the original kind of master's run of Kurosawa, Mizoguchi, Ozu, and all of those classics from the pre and immediate post-war era.
Yeah, I mean, those films are just so fantastic on so many levels. I remember one of the really beautiful discoveries of starting to really take film studies and media studies seriously was knowing that from seemingly every angle, these films are looked at with reverence. From a mainstream perspective, you have people, your prototypical, almost non-existent, but kind of when you think of your Reddit movies, big fan of Star Wars, even they probably have an appreciation or an understanding of oh, I love the movies that inspired George Lucas, Kurosawa. Or you have your really kind of quote unquote, again, an unfair stereotype, but your hoity-toity art critics who can look at someone like Mizoguchi or Ozu or even Kurosawa and say oh, there's just so much breathy content here to dissect and to look at as pieces of real high art. So and from there, how can you not be interested? It's the perfect introduction, in my opinion.
Oh, I think Kurosawa specifically is this amazing kind of introduction to the whole idea of the classic Japanese film, because his speaks to both like the high art crowd and on occasion the quote unquote low art crowd, although I don't think that's a distinction anymore. I think we've moved past these very easy binaries for how we engage with cinema. Like, Kurosawa was able to make very, very inspired, very heady kind of films, but at the same time, they spoke to very basic and understood perspectives, as well as, on occasion, he was known to do quite a great action film or a crowd pleaser, but with such technical craftsmanship that he kind of blended his whole audience between the high culture snobs, as you were talking about, and the people like Lucas, who was all just about like genre film. At least he became all about genre film.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, like, not only is there so much rich cultural subtext to look at from so many angles, but from a technical filmmaking standpoint, someone like Kurosawa, Ozu, they set such high bars and precedents for the rest of the industry from a completely image-based perspective, like from a completely understanding how effective editing works with editing with the eyes. And I know that was already kind of somewhat in existence before Kurosawa. Like, a lot of people say that Kurosawa, among others from his era, were inspired by the John Ford films. But I really think those cinematic techniques that are still so fundamental today, you can find them in Seven Samurai. You can find them in Tokyo Story, in a bunch of our kind of widely digested classic Japanese films. And there's just something so uniquely special about this generation that I still love revisiting these films endlessly. Like, so far, like, I don't think I'm ever going to stop revisiting these classics. They're so good.
Yeah, exactly. And even beyond just like a formalist standpoint, the basis of storytelling in these films, they speak to such, especially with the cinema of Kurosawa, they speak to such, like, as I said, understood human nature. It's so clear, so dogmatic, and it's so hard not to be moved by it. And I think for today's episode, we might be speaking about his most crushingly human story that he ever made. So I think we should just get straight into that with a synopsis. How about that?
Yeah, sounds good.
An aged bureaucrat who has dedicated his life to his unfulfilling work as a thankless cog in the public affairs office tries to find a new lease on life after a cancer diagnosis reveals to him he has never truly lived. With 6 months left to live, Kanji Watanabe takes a hard look at his life and spends his last days trying to find meaning in his existence. This is the story of Kurosawa's Ikiru, his 1952 Toho film from a script from his longtime collaborators Shinobu Hashimoto and Hideo Ogoni. Moss, why have you selected Ikiru for your Ega Night appearance?
So, I should preface Ikiru with the knowledge that in my second year of university, I had jumped headfirst into Kurosawa after High and Low. I had watched Seven Samurai. Essentially, Rashomon was another one of my big favorites. So, like, oh wow, big surprise. But I came across Ikiru after a recommendation from a friend of mine who said, "Hey, I know that you're also really interested in death on screen. Death was it still is a big interest of mine, but how we represent the end of life has been something that's just gripped me immensely." So I found out, you know, Ikiru, this film translated as to live, essentially, all about the encroachment of death, how we deal with it. I was infinitely – it is probably my favorite Kurosawa film, even though I have films that I might say are more entertaining or more pleasing. This is the film that I can return to, find new rewards every time, find new nuggets of insight and emotion that continue to captivate me, to be perfectly frank. Like, it's just a film that I can put on and just be consistently engaged by. I'll tear up. I'll laugh. I'll – you know, it's an emotional roller coaster. It's brilliant.
Like, I think the first time I ever saw this was not necessarily in a classroom setting, but that classroom setting kind of got me interested in going further down the Kurosawa hole, because it's such a rewarding body of films where everything kind of speaks to a new level of this man, of this director's very complex view of just humanism, of humanity on as a whole. I do remember the first time that I saw Ikaru, though, like, I was emotionally wrecked for days. This is such a rewarding sad story where after watching it you feel so crushed by the world, but you know that it's for a very clear purpose. It's trying to direct you into a new kind of mode of thinking with Watanabe's journey of self-discovery that he goes on, and it sets such a high precedent for these kind of films that deal with a character grappling with their own mortality, because there is so much humanism, so much like humanity spoken into this character, that it's hard to see anything trying the same story as a pale imitation.
Yeah. That's such a brilliant way of putting it. Like, after I watched Ikiru and I started watching other films again about grappling with mortality, that that sense of incoming death. Certainly, there's many, many great films that cover it. But when it comes to what Ikiru does, is I think still while retaining a sense of originality, despite being a film made covering a more general subject, but made in 1952, I still think it is probably the definitive film that talks about death for the living. So there's a lot, there's some stories that will often go on about the afterlife. You'll find that this is a lot of popular idea within some more religious cinemas or non-religious cinemas too. But I think about the forces of like life, such as like realizations of death, you know, with the scythe and everything, or realizations of angels with something like Wings of Desire, mm-hmm. or whatnot. They're all great and interesting, and I think they all add to a really interesting cinematic conversation. But when it comes to the film that talks about what it means to seize life in the face of death, I can't think of a better film than Ikiru, to be perfectly frank. And I know it's funny because it is almost in essence a small story, you know, just a story about this one like bureaucrat who has some problems with his family and kind of a tragic history with his wife passing away early on and not being there for his son in an emotional way. It sounds almost like a kitchen sink drama, but there's something so epic about it at the same time. Like, it's making these bold statements with such sweet, homey nuance that I can't get from any other film. It's awesome. I'm literally going to finish every sentence with just saying the film is great, I guess, by the sounds of it.
That's totally fair with a film like this. This is a veritable masterpiece, so it's okay if the conversation devolves into unbridled gushing about Ikaru, because, like, it's not my favorite Kurosawa, like, and that's a distinction that goes back and forth, especially as I discover more and more of his filmography, because the man made a lot of films. But
yeah,
it's like, I think what makes this film like stand out from all of those, like, as you said, like other films about like people grappling with this sense of mortality and trying to, in the face of death, really find life, it's that it's not that kind of black and white story where in the face of death they suddenly have this whole perspective change where they're a completely different person and they're living it to the fullest. Like, Kanji Watanabe, as played in an incredible tour de force performance by Takashi Shimura, it's like the knowledge of his death kind of stalls him a bit, and his quest for life includes a lot of failures. His perspective doesn't necessarily change because he doesn't know how to change that perspective. It's in the face of death, he kind of doesn't know what to do. And the film is that kind of journey to find something, anything to kind of hold on to when facing the great unknown. And unlike other films, this is purely, like you said, purely about living in the moment, like in your like corporeal form, because there's no kind of like acknowledgement of live good for it for your afterlife. It's live good for the moment, because this is the only life you would have. Yes, Ikuru is the original YOLO film.
Yeah, and that's the perfect way of putting it. It's the original YOLO film. It's a film that, like, I think both, yeah, it keeps that carpe diem attitude at its core. You know, it's both a film that represents, I feel like, the philosophies of a Stoic philosopher like Seneca, while also being very Buddhist in its nature, in terms of like the Buddhist teaching of accepting that everything is already broken, that things will be, that you will die, and thus looking at with that acceptance in mind, how that acceptance changes your relation to the world around you, to not just objects but your loved ones, what you want to see out of the world, how you contribute to it, like this kind of henceforth knowledge of I'm going to die, and this knowledge, what does this do to me right now, not just overall but right now? How does this influence my actions? How does it influence my feelings towards the outside world? I think that to me is something that when I started looking at the film, because I had known that I had really enjoyed the film, but for a while I didn't really ascribe it to like a meaning takeaway I got from it. I just knew that I found it really entertaining, and that I was like, well, this is really interesting. I like how he kind of I like how the film subverts your expectations with the almost the second half of it, but almost, or I guess like the third act of it, being where he's already kind of passed away, and we're piecing together information based on this on his funeral and the people having conversations at it.
It's a very like unassuming, almost anti-climax to it all.
Yeah, exactly. It's something that given the first half or so, or like two-thirds of the film, you get this sense that we're going to essentially probably die with him. The film would conclude when his life goes, but then it's almost like actually, never mind. His funeral is already happening. And even in the flashback sequences that we do see in that third act, his dialogue is pretty conservative. We don't get to see all that much of him. It's more about how other people are influenced, and they notice kind of the changes that he's brought with them, whether or not for good or for what is perceived to be bad by some of the sleazier bureaucrats.
Oh,
so
that
yeah.
Office. Like at the center of this film, like as well as this very, very kind of like subtle but grand statement on like a, not like the meaning of life, but a meaning of life, there is this bitter, like venomous attack on the bureaucratic nature of like the Japanese social systems that Kurosawa is clearly getting off his chest at the moment. This is a brutal takedown of that system.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting too, because it's, again, it could have decided as a film to be more focused on that expositionally. Like, we could have seen way more of it, but instead we spend far more time engaging with Watanabe's past with his son. We spend more time engaging with the silent moments of Watanabe as he like wanders through the nightclub and the streets with various companions that he kind of comes to along the way. The film is structurally constantly subverting our expectations of what's going to come next. And I think that's part and partial part of the point of the film, right? That's part of the kind of strange transformation that a character should go through if they really want to exit life fulfillingly, as according to the kind of supposed moral complex of the film. And I think that that's really interesting, because centrally the conclusion I've come to about the film is that it's a lot about transformation and the transforming of meaning in what's a good way of putting it? I suppose the transformation of meaning, and that transformation being a subversion to making your life better through the recognition that your life kind of sucks. And through the recognition of your problems, the solutions become far more simpler than you might have thought that they were. The ruts of your life aren't as bad as you might have thought they were already. You know, there's a sense of hopelessness that Watanabe loses the further he comes closer to death. And that's a very powerful, idea to put forward in your film. The idea that as you move closer to death, the more at peace you can become if you enact a sense of agency and you're willing to let those transformations of meaning take upon yourself. It's something that that keeps me coming back to the movie every time. I'm always like, oh, in what way am I now going to have my meanings of the film transformed? What am I going to notice now that's different?
Oh yeah, I can totally agree with that, because his whole journey to self-discovery and finding that meaning in life, it takes on so many forms, because, as I said, he doesn't know exactly what that meaning of life is for him. He can't find it in his family. They are very disconnected from him, and they're parasitically only interested in his pension and so forth. And he can't find it in his job, which has never been fulfilling for him, even though he spent, 30 years never missing a single date. And through these companions that he aligns himself with, the alcoholic author and Toyo, his subordinate at the office, he tries both their methods to find joy in life, and both leave him rather cold in the end, because it's their versions of joy in life, not his. And that realization that he never found that like base pleasure for existing, like you said, transforms him in a way, because the moment I forget which theorist brought this up in their reading of the film, but like that moment where he realizes he must do something for someone else, prove that the bureaucratic system can work for the better in some form, as he leaves that nightclub with Toyo, like people are singing like happy birthday as he leaves, and it's that kind of like very, not subtle, but very like clear distinction that he has been reborn in a sense with a new purpose and a new lease on life.
Yeah, God, I love that happy birthday scene, man. Oh my God, that's like the in being such a quote unquote obvious turning point of a film, it's so tremendously effectual when it happens that you can't help but get, like, I almost get like a little pep in my step when it happens. I'm like, yes, there he goes with the, he's excitedly walking down this, because you've just been waiting to see life in this protagonist for so long. You've been waiting to see this moment where his eyes are opening up and he's able to start actualizing himself. And it's so satisfying. And then it's at that point that they kill him.
That is... It's so amazing, because like he has that new pep in his step, that like suddenly that realization of what he has to do in order to find that meaning in his life. And we see him one last time at the office saying like, here's the plan we're going to do, and then smash cut to his funeral.
Yeah.
And it's like, I adore the decision. Like I kind of describe it as an anticlimax, but it's not really. It's like the perfect kind of topper to this story. But the only, like, it's such a dick move on Kurosawa's part, but it's one that really confirms the realities of the situation. It's like, no matter what we thought of this revelation of his, he was still destined to die. So that kind of bitter realization right after his point of like his highest point of self-actualization, just damn, that's a heavy hit.
Yeah, and it's also, yeah, it is a heavy hit. And I think that the reason that it's, again, so effective, like you said already, it's a subversion of our expectations that as it continues, what would initially seem like, oh, he's gone, and it, not just through flashback sequences, but again, what death initially seems like is just a picture and a funeral and we move on. But what death can become for those who really contemplate on it is a transformative process. Even though realistically at the end it seems like the bureaucrats, they're all kind of like drunkenly saying, like, yes, we're going to all try and be like Watanabe. We're all really going to try and actualize ourselves and push for change no matter what. It doesn't seem like they're actually going to do it. That there's a sense of naivete that comes from it, except for one of them, one of the bureaucrats, who does seem genuinely shaken, and he's the kind of concluding image of the film, where he's nervously and anxiously looking off at Watanabe's last kind of contribution to society and wondering, will I be able to live with that image? Will I, or to leave that legacy? And it's great too, because he's...
Go ahead.
Again, it's his perception again. Now the perception of playground means something different to someone else. So it's like that transformation of meaning making, that reorganization of a meaning in someone's, I don't know, internal calculus can change someone's life. While, you know, that's the best thing that we can do with our death, is to hopefully leave some impact for the living, right? Leave a positive change. So at the end, a simple, almost epic message, but done through such a tight, nuanced manner. I just find it something that Kurosawa just, and not just in Ikiru, like in almost all of his films, just nails every time. Like,
oh yeah.
Every time? Like, I'm just waiting for the dud of a Kurosawa movie to come across my lap, and it just never happens. I don't understand how someone could understand storytelling and subtext so well and so effectively. It's so impressive.
Like, the man was in a league of his own, and that's very much clear. Like, his body of work makes a claim for that. I adore that sequence at the end, though, because at this drunken funeral, as people are getting more maudlin the more they think about Watanabe's disposition in his final days, and whether or not he knew that he had the cancer, because he never told anybody that he did. And that kind of sequence, from this rallying cry to live life to its fullest, to the business as usual at the office, knowing that no one has the conviction to really follow through as Watanabe did and sees life for all it's worth, and then, like, another cut to the most iconic scene in the film of Watanabe enjoying the fruits of his labor, knowing that both there's going to be a mark left of his work, like, on this planet well after he dies, and knowing that he did it for the right reason, like, not necessarily a selfish reason of for that fulfillment, but, like, an active... like taking an active role in a community and changing it for the better, knowing that he had that power all along. He's just so content sitting on that swing set, singing
Gondola no Uta.
Yes, that song that takes on, like, a new kind of context, because originally it's this lament that he sings during the nightclub sequence with the alcoholic author, where saying that life is brief, and kind of realizing that he has wasted much of his life, to that final sequence where the song takes on a whole new meaning for him. It's like a prideful boast, if anything, at the end. And I just so adore that ending sequence and how that works out. That, and especially that shot of him in the snow, just swinging on that swing set, just like finally content with his life for the first time in God knows how long. It all comes down to Shimura's performance, which is one of the most affecting, emotionally driven performances, I think, of not just like the golden age of Japanese cinema, but like the entire span of it. This is like an all-time great performance. And like, Shimura kind of has this quality about him where he's like the Jimmy Stewart of Japan, where like his face is so expressive, and the simplest non-movements of it and expressions can move you so powerfully. He is just like a brilliant actor, and I'm so glad that he had such a fruitful partnership with Kurosawa, appearing in many of his films. Mifune is clearly is Kurosawa's like number one boy, but Shimura was like the second tier, always there and always with a good, if not great, performance.
Oh yeah, it's I think it's one of my friends, when I showed it to them, I showed it to a big group of friends who, not the biggest fan of world cinema, but I had actually already shown them Seven Samurai, and they had known Shimura's performance from there, and as well as Rashomon as well. So they were like, "Man, one of my friends, his name's Evan, said he's like the I like that you said the Jimmy Stewart, because he's just like Evan said, he's like a Morgan Freeman or Tom Hanks of like this era." But Shimura also has his, and then Evan went on. He said like he even, but he also has his own really unique quality where it's a great, you know, comparison, but in all honesty, no one can be similar to Shimura because of his like variety of performances, because they had also just seen him in the original Godzilla, Honda Godzilla. So he was like, man, this guy can be a perfectly fine minor professor character that doesn't really do a lot of the kind of bigger emotional pieces, but can kind of be a totem-esque figurehead, but at the same time he can give you the perfect pit of humanity, that perfect sad face, that feeling of complete dread, anxiety, confusion, and then a somber satisfaction at the end with Ikiru. Like, his character arc, I don't know if there's anyone else who could express it as perfectly as Shimura has. And you bring up such a good point where, like, Mifune may get a lot of the big credit, as he deserves.
No disparaging Mifune on this podcast.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. Like, there's no way. But Shimura, to me, is one of those, like, I feel still deserves to be a household name, in like, just as much as Mifune, you know what I mean? Important. And this film, I feel like, doesn't get enough credit for his lead performance. I know obviously it's cherished pretty widely, even in world cinema circles, but I still feel like it doesn't I still feel like, man, people should be citing this movie all the time in terms of like classic cinema, because when it comes to I don't know, maybe like a historicized character arc film of accepting death, I can't think of a better performance piece to show you like the true acting chops of Shimura.
No, not at all. And the general thing about Shimura is like, as you were saying with his many collaborations with Kurosawa, is he has such a range to him. Same with Mifune, like they could do a lot of different roles, but with Shimura it's so detectable between like this and Seven Samurai. In this, he is like a perennially confused person who's like the weight of the world is breaking down on him because of this this revelation about his cancer diagnosis. Like, he doesn't know what to do with his time anymore. Like, everything doesn't seem right. In Seven Samurai, when he's playing Kanbei, like the leader of the whole group, he is so like in control, so thought out, so wise, and so like assured in everything he does. It seems like an almost like different person is doing that role, and they weren't that far apart. I mean, like Seven Samurai was only 2 years later, I believe.
Yeah. Or even his smaller role in Rashomon, where he's playing this random agriculture worker that discovers this murder scene. Like, he's like a completely different person in just body language immediately. You can tell, like, him just kind of throwing that axe over his shoulder, walking through the forest. This is not Watanabe. You then watch that performance in Ikiru, and it's like, holy crap, he embodies this completely other person, all of their historical context of this character in just a walk, and then everything else just flows from there. It's I mean, again, maybe I'm just noticing something that all great actors do. It's like, wow, Anthony, I can't believe you notice body language. But still, Shimura just, you know, it's like, granted that, but I can't get over the quality that is brought into it. Another thing I wanted to say too is another thing that often gets overlooked on this film, and I'm not saying that Shimura gets overlooked, but one thing that does is Fumio Hayasaka's music. That this film has a strange variety of music in its score, but it works every time, even though sometimes it initially might feel out of place. there's some points where you think, oh, why is there music here? This doesn't feel like this is necessary. But then within like a few seconds of listening to it and seeing a scene develop with music in the background, because it's not a score heavy film, but when it is implemented, or it feels like it's implemented, like the music that's in the background of a nightclub scene, it feels so out of place at first, but then perfectly in place. I still don't understand how they do it, because usually when a score feels out of place, it completely derails everything for me in terms of like my film watching experience. But
I can
this
agree
one,
with that totally.
Yeah, and in this film, even though there's times where I do feel like it initially will start off differently, again, connecting to that feeling that I have where it's all about transformation of meaning, these subversions of expectations are made to kind of make us think, like, how is it that I can appreciate a scene almost, you know? Like, how is it that Hayasaka's score can both at first feel weird, but then suddenly feel so at home and suddenly feel like the scene wouldn't be possible without this score. I can't think of any scenes off the top of my head right now, admittedly, which I apologize for, but trust me, it really is something.
No, and like the best thing about the score is it's very much like the whole tone of the film in general. It's very unassuming. It's not like attempting to guide the viewer into a certain like emotional state. It's very much there as an accent to it, because with most of these scenes, we are just so drawn to Watanabe, his like position as well as like his framing in most of these shots, which make him seem so small and insignificant in a lot of these compositions that Kurosawa works through. But the music is always there just as a nice little button point on it. And yeah, like the sad thing about Hayasaka is like he had a nice fruitful collaboration with Kurosawa for a couple of films, but his like sudden death in 55, I want to say. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 1955 kind of put an end to that before they could really explore the range of their partnership in Kurosawa's filmography. He did like do some very notable ones, like a Seven Samurai, I believe, mm-hmm, was his, mm-hmm. Stray Dog and Rashomon both. So like it was a brief partnership, but he if you were to ever like partner with Kurosawa on certain films, he picked all the right ones.
Yeah, there's no question. It's yeah, it's such a now that I completely forgot that you know, he died at, you know, 1955. What a loss. Such mm-hmm. a shame. Yeah, and I mean, like, one of the things that I think happens oftentimes, at least with me, is I'll get so caught up in the director or an actor's performance that I start forgetting things about like the sound design or you know, minor other character performances that make the film feel more lived in and the world feel more the world of the film feels more not necessarily realistic but more embodiable. It makes me feel like I can kind of jump in here, which is interesting considering like the setting is both, you know, highly specific to a lot of Japanese cultural contexts of the time, you know, a dissatisfaction with local bureaucracy, growing kind of feelings that a previous Japanese culture was leaving them and that it wouldn't be able to be recovered. It was dying, so to speak. But I still feel like this is a universal tale. Again, something that Kurosawa just manages to do, maybe even better than some of his other contemporaries, is make these stories that are so perfectly tailored to the Japanese audience of his time and even further down the road, as well as me right now, like in my life, you know, in Ontario, Canada. Like, I don't understand how he does it, but yeah, something pretty brilliant about that too.
Yeah, they are very specific, like, cultural context that he's drawing from, like, rolled into this film. Like, not only is this dissatisfaction with the inefficiency of the Japanese bureaucratic system, but there's also this sense that the once reprised family system that's upheld as, like, the backbone of the country is decaying rapidly, as well as this kind of generational divide that as you get older, you are less and less significant to society. And these were, like, widespread, like, notions, especially in, like, the post-war era when Japan was reconstructing itself and, like, they were thinking, like, what values are we going to be taking into the new Japan, you know, like, not as the empire anymore. But it's funny, like, how we're, like, drawing on this idea that it's also a universal theme, and because it is, it's so simple in a sense, like, because who hasn't had that intense dissatisfaction with bureaucracy? Who hasn't had this notion that they are not living their life to the fullest? And seeing it worked out in such an expert detail, but like at the same time so simple and straightforward, with all this depth just hiding underneath the surface, is so satisfying. And it's funny because earlier when we were speaking of Shimura's performance, and like I said, he was the like Japanese Jimmy Stewart. You mentioned Tom Hanks. I think it was your friend who said that. There was a planned remake of this in like 2003 with Tom Hanks.
No way. Really?
Proposed a star. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I was gonna say like Tom Hanks or Morgan Freeman, like, you know, like the kind of iconic figureheads are like almost, I don't feel like it's a fair term, but the patriarchs of like current American Hollywood cinema, you know, that would mm-hmm. be the, but even then it's, wow, really? Yeah, that's funny. Huh.
I never knew that. And it could work. Like it absolutely could work because Kurosawa, more than any of the classic directors, had so many of his films like repackaged into different cultural contexts. I mean, like we wouldn't have much of spaghetti Western without Kurosawa's films. We wouldn't have so much like Seven Samurai just becomes a Magnificent Seven, and that's a very clean transition. Like you don't really lose much of that because Kurosawa essentially made a Western with samurais in it.
Yeah, and I think that like to even again the powerful nuance of Kurosawa is that he can be like translated on a micro and macro scale, right? Like I could now that I'm thinking about it, could you imagine like a Ben Nichols directed, or like maybe I can't even think of a decent like alternative Western director to pick, but like a Tom Hanks or Morgan Freeman like main character, you know, a Morgan Freeman version of Watanabe, but set in, I don't know, New York City or something, of this dissatisfied bureaucrat, or maybe even a private sector worker, like an insurance broker who feels like they've done nothing with their life. I feel like the transition probably wouldn't be as graceful as I'd want it to be, but I'm just imagining that would be interesting to see. Do you have any picks for like a director who you'd want to try and adapt a Western Ikiru, or even just another version of it?
I think because Kurosawa just in general had such a range to his style and could be both intensely emotionally driven in one sense and then stylistically driven in another. For some reason, I would love to see Malick take this on.
Oh, that's a really interesting pick. And now that I'm thinking about it, that'd be really cool.
Because like there is, like with an Ikiru, it's such a simple, straightforward story that so much could be done with its visual language. Not to disparage like the original, because it is so expertly shot and wonderfully mm-hmm. composed, and I, like, especially those montage sequences of the nightlife that they try and experience, they are so beautifully rendered. But I would love to see like a director like Malick or Nichols would be an interesting pick too, to really explore like what we can do with the story, like on a visual standpoint purely. But like it's funny because you keep saying Morgan Freeman, because like he made that film. It was called The Bucket List, and it was a piece of shit.
That's right. Oh my god, I completely forgot about that. Oh no, not The Bucket List. Yeah. Okay, like, never mind.
Do you listen to the Next Picture Show podcast?
No, but I just recently subscribed to a bunch of new podcasts, and that was one of them. So I will start listening to it very soon.
Yeah, like the conceit of the Next Picture Show podcast is that they take a, like, everything's better in context is their whole shtick. So like they take a recently released film and look at a film from the past that kind of like influenced it or is like makes a nice pairing. And I'm just imagining like Ikaru and The Bucket List, and man, what a drop off in quality.
Yeah, wow. Yikes. That's a great comparison though. That would be a great paper or a video essay, like doing a comparison between like what makes a more effective story about encroaching death, you know, like even just looking at like the subtext of the story, like obviously one just being so much more interesting as a piece of study than the other, but like also the effectiveness of filmmaking technique. Oh yeah, that'd be fun.
Well, like, but one is structured around the idea of like we have to live life to its fullest, aka fullest as in as big as possible, live it up. So like, you know, they're traveling all around the world and experiencing all these things like they would never get to do if they didn't have this push that's coming from the grave to actually do these things. And with Ikaru, there isn't that same kind of conceit. It's just more like I don't feel like my life has been lived up to this point. Like I've never experienced this kind of happiness before. And yeah, it just wouldn't work in the other context. Like, I don't want to see Shimura, like, having dinner on the top of a goddamn pyramid.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, you could also, like, take a look at, like, what each story, and maybe not to, like, completely, like, bag on The Bucket List. Well, actually, no, I guess I will. But, like,
go ahead. That, no one likes that movie.
That story to me is, like, very, very much kind of encroached in like a sense of neoliberal capitalism where like you could even do a almost Marxist reading of Ikiru in terms of looking at well, I mean, not totally, I guess it would be a more neoliberal democratic kind of social democracy view of it, but looking at like the ways that within bureaucracy, as long as a sense of self-actualization is done within our elected leaders or our anointed leaders, we could see success in society and like with and encouraging that compassion for you know those mothers at the beginning of Ikiru who are just in that great montage where they're just being tossed around this system of stasis, this government that never does anything, you know, this public board of people who would just rather send you to the other person to deal with until they eventually get back to you.
Their whole job is to find that one discrepancy that makes it not their job anymore. And just that constant shuffling of those poor women from it's such a funny sequence from station to station, like, you know, pest control, sewage control, city planning up to the mayor and then back to the public affairs office at the end. It's such a vicious critique that Kurosawa, like, normally a very, like, nice kind of director who is very much focused on this dogmatic sense of humanism, just letting the malfunctioning bureaucratic system have it, and how they are not interested in the public at all, just in pawning off the problems onto the next person down the line.
Yeah, yeah, essentially, like, The brilliant critique of having a people's government that does not give a crap about its people, you know, like it's again such a multifaceted critique of a very specific cultural context of Japan of its time, as well as something that still unfortunately is relevant to this very day. And sorry,
my favorite one is when they go to sewage control. It's like somewhere in the middle of that whole montage of them changing windows. And the only thing that sewage control guy tells them, which is enough to get it off his plate, is like, so you say there's a lot of mosquitoes, huh? That's probably pest control. Go over there.
Yeah, like it's just, it's funny. It's a dark sense of humor too. And there's this strange sense of catharsis at the end of the film when we see the mothers crying at the wake or I guess at the funeral or mm-hmm. whatever it I suppose is, they kind of they're the point of where we started off as feeling that these people are hopeless, and they come in and are completely reminding us all of it's like the humor doesn't necessarily go away, but if suddenly we're reminded, oh, actually we've been laughing at people who are facing a real problem, and just having that acknowledged has brought them to tears that this person like passed away. Not just that they're crying because of such a sweet thing that he did, but they're crying because he might have been their only person who they could talk to, and now he's dead. Because
he was
that's
the only
how...
one. He was the only one to ever give a shit. And yeah. Not just care, but make it a priority. Like these women who live in that neighborhood where like a cesspool is forming from like sewage backup. Like they have never. They have like felt like they have been just been looked over constantly, and this one man like comes along, and like that's what that whole that like spearheads that whole conversation at the wake is like, did Watanabe build that park, or was it was it the system that built that park? And as those women come in, it's very clear that like no, that was his initiative, and you can see in those in that montage sequence of like memories that people have of him working on that project. There's that one great, simple, dialogue-free scene of him on the job site falling over, and him and all the women coming who live in that neighborhood coming over to his aid and taking him off and caring for him. So it's that kind of like mutual, like to do something good for people comes back for you.
Yeah, yeah, and it's interesting too because. You know, because you're totally right. That message is still there, and it still retains a sense of individuality for Watanabe to kind of for his lasting legacy. And if we all acted like Watanabe, regardless if we had a death sentence essentially given to us, we could all make our world a better place. It's a beautiful message. At that same time, it's also it's also really interesting because to make a strange what will initially seem like a strange leap in logic, I compare it almost to like a pseudo Batman message, if that makes any sense, like politically, in that Batman as a character has a lot of tools that he could have used, like his immense wealth, to systemically change Gotham, but his action is more of a hyper-individualist one, saying that I don't mind stepping on the toes of the police force, but I'm going to bring these criminals to justice because you guys aren't doing your job properly, and it makes more sense for me to actualize my own sense of justice because that seems more effective and less encumbered by this system of government, versus Watanabe, who again, in a micro way, steps on other people's toes and makes other people look bad, but his actions as someone who didn't really care that much about going through the quote-unquote proper channels is still like the good one. You know, we can all tell that what he did, how he actualized himself, is the one that made the difference, and it's the real beauty of the story. It's like he was looking elsewhere throughout his whole life to find meaning, when really all he had to do was actualize himself in what he was already actually interested in. You know, working for other people, leaving that legacy, is ultimately what makes your life really satisfying. So again, weird comparison to Batman, but if you look at it from a political lens, you can kind of see like what is a similar sense of political critique within these two characters. One being one way more obviously like hyper realized and capitalist than the other, but still I don't know, in thinking about it, it was a comparison that I thought was kind of weird but interesting.
No, I think that's not too far out of left field. It's very much how is Watanabe supposed to enact change in a system that is broken, and so he has to like work through that system and go around it whenever necessary in order to enact those very real, tangible changes in the community, which is what that system is supposed to be doing all along. And that also makes the climax very much like a very like kind of nuanced portrayal of both like it's a sad ending as well as a bit of a happy ending, because yes, like he is able to do something in his last 6 months, and even using like the tools that were at his disposal, like his job, like that he's been doing for 30 years. But when you think about that, it means that he could have done so much more in those 29 years beforehand.
Yeah,
and that's just like that kind of bitter release at the end. It's like, what can we really call upon from one man in his very short span of time on this earth? And he did something, and that's more than anyone else in that bureaucratic office could probably say. But they now have the opportunity because of his example, and as we said at the ending, none of them seem to follow it. They don't have that conviction or follow through that he did, and it took stomach cancer to get him to that point. So very much, it's like that system, while can be salvaged, can't necessarily work.
Yeah, yeah. Again, such a great nuanced critique of it, right? Like it's not necessarily giving you a big overall solution to death, to bureaucracy, to individualism versus working to solve problems of a group collective. It doesn't, and it's not concerned with giving you any of those like bigger answers, but through a smaller culturally specific answer, it kind of does give you a bigger sense of what's right or wrong in terms of like how to live a satisfying life, even if you're at the very end of it. It's a story that demands an awareness to a problem that realistically you can't really even imagine until you are actually faced with it. Yet you can still take away enough from it to know that like, oh, you know what? You're right. I shouldn't be wasting my time, or I guess not wasting your time, but I guess I shouldn't be, or I should renegotiate the meanings of my life. Look at where I can find more fulfillment and how I can immediately actualize it. And, you know, that's that brilliance of that little, like, toy that Toyo gives him, right? Like, that moment where he sees what initially just seems like a stupid little toy that he wouldn't give a crap about, but he sees what that's, like, her source of joy when she explains it. She says, I feel like I'm giving a toy – I think the line – I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but when I make this toy, it feels like I'm giving it to every kid in Japan. It feels like I'm contributing to society more, even though yes, she's working in a factory and probably being underpaid and exploited and but she is making her existence satisfying, whether or not it's overall a good or a bad thing. Her existence and her satisfaction is what drives her and what gives her that sense of life that Watanabe just desperately was looking for but couldn't find. And he ends up like that vague kind of attraction to Toyo at first. You know, I thought like, oh, I hope this doesn't get any weird. I hope this isn't weird. And and because, you know, it very well could have been. And that's just the way that movie could have been. But
that's what his son and his brother think.
Yeah. But again, playing with that expectation, subverting the meanings that you might already come to, because that's when you end up realizing, oh, no, this is actually like really, really genius. This is – he's so enamored by her, not because he's attracted to her necessarily. He's there because he recognizes – like, what are you doing? How are you being faced with this crappy job where you're, like, telling bad jokes, you know, during it and stuff? Like, how are you enduring and still smiling and still moving on? It can't just be your youth, right? Because that's what he's really worried about when he's with her. He's like,
yeah,
if it's just her youth and I'm old, it's over. I have nothing. But that toy is like, wait a minute. It's not the youth – oh, geez, sorry. that toy is like, it's not just the toy. It's the kind of meaning making that she has reorganized from the toy, what she gets from the actual awareness of making it. And that's what he does. Immediately he's like, okay, well, what do I enjoy about this work? It's about helping people. So then he goes and does just that. He doesn't give a shit about anything else. He just goes to help people.
Yeah, like that whole revelation with the toy. I believe the line is something more along the lines of, when I make these, it feels like I'm playing with every child in Japan. And like, it kind of speaks to her very naive disposition of this eternal pleasure seeker. And that's why Watanabe like attaches himself to her, not like not in a sexual way at all, although that's what it's perceived to be, like, from everyone. It's played for like a lot of laughs, how his son and his son's wife view them leaving the house, and they think he's got a mistress that's like pumping him for all the money that he's worth. And like from that point, he realized like the answer is quite simple, is that we make our own fulfillment. Hers is on this assembly line making these wind-up rabbit toys. His comes from his job, and he just was too clouded to see that originally. I do love during that montage of him experiencing life through her eyes, and them going to all these very quick kind of pleasures, like, you know, go out for good food, roller skating. My favorite one is when they go to the movies together and he falls asleep. it's just that subtle little joke on the point where it's like, this isn't working for him, but he's trying something. And I do love their kind of dynamic that they have going throughout that entire montage of the ever chipper child and this downtrodden man who really just can't get at that energy level. Like, that's like literally the only time we hear him laugh, and Shimura has a wonderful laugh. So yeah, like I do think you're right on the money with that reading of Toyo and her role in his self-actualization.
I think you're also, like, all those observations are totally true as well. Like, there she is just such an interesting character, and she gives him the information, not necessarily the information, but like the perspective that writer, who I'm not sure if Haruo Tanaka, if that was his son, played Watanabe's son, but I forget his name, but he's got an amazing face. He plays the like noir writer who's like looking for inspiration, and
that was Yonosuke Ito.
Yes, Ito. That's the I remember. I've seen him in other films, and I just recognize his face immediately. Even his role, what almost seems like the beginning of something with their meeting, turns out to be somewhat of a failure in terms of he thinks, oh well, I will give him hedonism. I will provide him a joyous night of camaraderie, drinks, and women to oogle, and you know, like I that'll be our fun stuff. And he, you know, what initially seems Watanabe is trying to get into it, and he just can't. There's just this wall preventing him. It's just not for him. He thinks that that's what he wants, but every time it's almost like he's kind of put into this light show where he's like mysteriously looking around, like, oh my god, like, yeah. All of these sensations are almost overwhelming, and he thinks he wants it, but ultimately he's just like, you know, he's throwing up in that alleyway, and he's just, I can't do this. This is not satisfying to me.
He goes to a nightclub where everyone's trying to have a good time, and he requests like the saddest song ever written.
Right? Yeah. Gondola no Uta.
That scene is so amazing. How everyone around them just stops dead and takes a look at the spectacle he's making of himself. Where, like, the drink has clearly turned to maudlin, and he is overly sentimental, and that face that he makes as he cries is burned into, like, my retinas. It's the most emotionally affecting image I think I've ever seen in Japanese cinema. It's just so heartbreaking and moving. And like you mentioned, like, the novelist, Ito's face, but, like, as the camera pans away from this intense close-up of Shimura, we see him off the side, just like his mouth open agape, just wondering what his partner is doing at this moment. I also love the way that Ito is dressed. He's like you said, like a noir figure, because like, he seems like completely out of place everywhere he goes. You know, almost like a fictional, like, figment of his imagination that's just there to help him navigate through this impenetrable pleasure world that he's introducing him to.
Yeah, that's actually a really brilliant observation. He does always really look out of place. I never really thought of that, but I love that image of him just kind of being on the left hand side of the frame, looking at him in like this sense of despair of like, I can't help this guy. It is just bleaker than bleak, and I have no idea where to start to help him. You know, like
is that realization this is not for him. Like, I am wasting his time.
Yeah. And it's like, I'm trying to give him something to satisfy his acknowledgement of the void. Like, you know, Watanabe is staring into a Nietzschean void of sorts, saying that, like, I am going to die. I have wasted my youth. There's nothing I can do. And Ito's character is just like, I would love to tell you that there it's not this way, but it is. And I have no solution. My solutions are not enough for you. And it's the perfect kind of stepping stone to lead him to Toyo, I think, to tell him that, like, actually, this superficial, quick, hedonistic pleasure is probably not what you need right now. Sure, it's not necessarily demonizing it or saying that it's not useful, but for someone who's at the very edge of their life, who is older, who needs a sense of fulfillment that is deeper, that will lead them to a peaceful rest, I don't know if maybe the nightclub was the right spot. I just love that scene too. Yeah, because you mentioned it. It's like you could drop a pin in that room and you would hear it. Everyone was just like, oh boy, yeah. And he's the only one singing along with it too. And no one stops him either, which I find really interesting. Everyone gives him this moment because it's just that bleakness is so stark. It immediately forces you into its recognition. You have to almost acknowledge it, like, oh yeah, you're at your edge and none of us can help you. I just thought brilliant.
I think we've all had one of those moments where, like, you are with someone and you're both having, like, a good time, like, either at a bar or something, and something just changes in their disposition, and you realize that you're going to be spending, like, the next so much amount of time comforting them or just letting them have their moment. It articulates that so well to a very uncomfortable degree, but it becomes, like, a much more nuanced scene than just, like, simple sympathy for him, because, like, we know his purpose for being there. We know what he's trying to do, and it's just not working, and everyone's staring, and I think that Ito does the good thing and just, like, picks him up and says, like, that's the spirit, and starts singing the song again as he marches him out backwards.
Yeah, it's, yeah, and you know what, that's another really solid point. I was, like, I remember those, there's been those moments where, you are not necessarily forced to, but the situation calls for a moment of perhaps, whether it's silence or just a moment where you have to acknowledge this person going through something that perhaps you can't give immediate advice to or try and give a cathartic quick response that will make the person go, that will resolve those problems for that period of time. There's just a point where you have to recognize this person is going through something you can't, and that you should probably just be there for them, because otherwise you're not really going to be much help. And I think that's funny because you're, in essence, it's not Toyo that tells him something that changes him. It's not like Toyo's direct advice is what transforms him. His moment of His moment of transformation is just like putting two and two together. It's having this this robot kind of this toy that's connected to youth in a way, but it's really his recognition of, oh, it's not necessarily materialism or hedonism that I've been missing. It's my sense of purpose, my drive. What I can do right now with my tools, rather than trying to find some kind of mystery cure-all, I need a sense of fulfillment, and that sense of fulfillment with that happy birthday scene is just so timeless. Yeah, sometimes I just look up that scene on YouTube to watch whenever I need, like, a quick pick me up. Like, I'll just be like, right, yeah, I have things I can do right now. You know, I don't need some mystery advice, some, like, some quick action that I can do to help me. There's Because it's not that simple. It's that I have to look at what I already have sometimes, renegotiate those meanings, and see what I can do with that. What are the meanings that I have that I already – that or have been under my nose this whole time that can then potentially provide those sense of – that sense of fulfillment?
Yeah, sometimes you don't really need to look outside of what's at your disposal or, like, what's in your – like, your – like, the circle that you occupy, like, from a, on a day-to-day basis. Sometimes the answer – has been there all along. In another film, like, he may have found that in his family, but no such luck here, especially within like the historical context of where this film emerges. So he looks back to his job and it makes the most sense. So it's not simple, but sometimes it can be like that straightforward. It's just you need to change your perspective and on like what you've been doing for the past 30 years.
Yeah. It's like a renegotiation of like your labor. It's a renegotiation of like what you find satisfying about your life, right? And with a film like It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart, he finds that meaning, especially at the end within his family. That family as your ideological state structure, kind of being our returning sense of home. But for Ikiru, it takes a far more critical perspective, I think, and it takes a far more interesting one. Not to say that his family was the solution, but that perhaps if it was the solution, perhaps that time has passed. Perhaps his son, like, will feel grief, but he has his wife. What can you do when your options are so limited? Well, it turns out that, like, labor and your work, your skills, your contribution to society doesn't even have to be based on providing for a family, but it can be providing for multiple families, providing for just one other individual. There's just so many ways that life can be satisfying. And Ikiru, in a way, is part of a larger philosophical puzzle, right? I think it's an integral film for anyone who's struggled with meaning for life to watch. Because even if it's not going to give you the necessary direct semiotic meaning that you want, it does give you that subtext of, hey, life is a transforming process. Life is actually all based on your perspective in a certain way, not completely relativistic per se, but there's a lot of things that once you start renegotiating the meanings you get from the objects around you, whether or not those are even like Baudrillard objects, like other people or individuals in your life, the other from your existence. Once you start renegotiating the process of meaning making, everything, anything could be satisfying. Even a shitty bureaucratic job that you know that seems hopeless at first. You know, anything. Your expectations are really what defines the enjoyment you can get out of it. I just think that's like, to me, especially when I originally watched it, I was not necessarily super happy or pleased with myself. And I'm not saying that like my whole life is happy-go-lucky right now, but I'd say I'm in a much better spot. And Ikiru, I won't lie, it's a contributing factor to that.
I could 100% sign off on that statement. This is a film that can really change your lease on life just through its simple way of breaking down these much greater concepts of like self-fulfillment. And I think that's gonna do it for the episode. Is there anything else you wanted to mention? Because just real quick, this was obviously critically acclaimed in Japan. It won several Best Film Awards, like the Kinema Jumbo Award and the Mainichi Film Awards. And little note that didn't come up in the conversation, but it's partly based on a Leo Tolstoy novella, Ivan Illovich.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's just kind of, it just kind of more, adding more fuel to Kurosawa's intense fascination with Russian literature. He would go on to adapt other classics, especially Tolstoy, in his later career. So is there anything else you wanted to mention before we wrap it up?
And also Kurosawa adapted some Chekhov as well. And of course, his appreciation for Shakespeare as well. Just, you know, all over. But yeah, like, interesting Russian stuff. I don't know. I think that does it for me. I don't know if I... I've probably missed a bunch of other details I've loved about it. I made a whole video essay on YouTube about it, so if you want maybe a more structured appreciation of that film, go check that out. But that's pretty much it for me.
Okay, well, Moss, you mentioned video essays a couple of times. I'm pretty sure you do better numbers than this podcast does, but if you want the opportunity, go ahead and plug that, because I have watched your essay on the film, and it's very good.
Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, it's one of my favorite all-time films. I consider it a life-changing film, so I knew I'd have to write about it. Eventually, I'm going to get through all of my favorite films in terms of doing an essay on it. I'm over on YouTube at Moss Arts. That's M-O-S-S space Arts. If you look me up, or just Moss Arts Ikiru, you should be able to find the channel. I'm still going to be making videos in the future. Not all of them, I'll admit, are based on film, but a lot of them are essentially pieces of art criticism that I'm it's what I do. And it's also what you do as well. That's Moss Arts. I also, I'll just plug another podcast that my friend Zach and I do called I Went to Film School. You can check it out essentially wherever you get your podcasts. The whole point of that podcast is just interviewing people who went to film school and their impressions of their respective institutions. Ikiru is one of the best films ever, and I'm going to stand by that statement. That's my like last word, I guess.
I can totally agree with that. There's a reason when you mentioned when we were originally discussing like for your guest appearance what film you would want to talk about, that one stuck out to me, and like the couple of titles you sent to me, it's like, oh man, I cannot wait to rewatch that film again. It's so good. But yeah, like it's currently available to stream on Criterion Channel, I believe, as well as widely available on DVD thanks to the Criterion collection, who has an understandable love of Kurosawa's film, having released all of them.
Yeah, which is good. We need a new Redbeard re-release, by the way, Criterion. If you're listening, please get on that. Get a Blu-ray out.
Oh yeah, yeah, they're a sponsor of the podcast. Yeah, I and nailed that down.
Oh yeah. Oh, me too. They're always. I'm always in communication with them. You know, we go way back.
Oh, have you been to the closet? It's wonderful. You gotta go.
My God, could you imagine? That's like a personal fantasy of mine. Getting invited to do a Criterion Closet video, I'd be there all day.
I like. Kind of a tangent, but like, why doesn't everyone do what Barry Jenkins and Lulu Wang did, where they walk in, take everything, and leave? It's just like, don't you people love movies? What's wrong with you?
Yeah, have you seen the Safdie Brothers video? They just take everything. It's brilliant. Oh god, it's so good.
They're such great videos, because like you get an opportunity to see like the breadth of their film knowledge and just like how much that these directors that we are all interested in, who are like whose careers are budding, are like so invested in the classics and so film knowledgeable. And it's just like, man, you could just spend a whole day going through that catalog of Criterion Closet videos.
Yeah, it's awesome.
All right, well, that's gonna do it for Egg and Night. Thank you so much, Moss, for joining me.
Thank you. It's honestly my pleasure. I could talk about this movie forever, and Japanese cinema forever, honestly.
Thank you. We appreciate that. And if this podcast is at all successful, we hope that everyone could be at that point where just like the notion of talking about Japanese films fills them with excitement. That's the stated goal of what me and Aruba are trying to do here.
Well, I'm happy to help try to contribute to that in any way possible.